On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the man who invented the phrase conventional wisdom, but he was anything but conventional. John Kenneth Galbraith, iconoclastic economist and liberal lion, died on Saturday. He was 97. Galbraith was a giant by any measure, 6'8" tall, with an intellect and humanity that loomed larger still. His 1958 book, The Affluent Society, took a wrecking ball to post-war America's sense of itself and sparked a national reevaluation of values. Galbraith served high in the World War II administration. He was an influential advisor to great society Democrats John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. He served as U.S. ambassador to India. Denounced by some for being an economist of more powerhouse style than substance, the two-time Medal of Freedom winner once shot back, "If you can't comfort the afflicted, then afflict the comfortable." In 2002, I interviewed Galbraith at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This hour on Point, we listen back to that conversation with John Kenneth Galbraith. And later in the hour, we'll look at Galbraith's legacy with Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Solow. Galbraith was 93 when we spoke, his hearing imperfect, but his mind perfectly clear. It was March 11th, 2002, 6 months after the 9/11 attacks. Terrorism and war were in the news. So was the spectacular implosion of Enron. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman had just written that, ultimately, history would view the Enron scandal as more significant than the attacks of September 11th. I began our conversation by asking John Kenneth Galbraith what he made of that.
Well, he's a very acute and clever man, but I wouldn't attribute quite that ranking, although Enron was certainly very important and is very important, even as we talk today. The level of activity of a questionable sort, you notice how careful I am in my language.
I do.
Was spectacular in that case. And since I make some pretense to economics, it was the one that came in most strongly on me. I had for years taught about corporations, but I was never prepared for anything quite so ridiculous, quite so fantastic as Enron.
What do you think created the corporate culture that allowed Enron to happen?
Oh, I would say there were several things. First, there has always been a big concession to corporate power. It has been assumed that the corporation is slightly above criticism, taken for granted, and doesn't have the close critical attention that even an individual would expect. And there is also the deference that is paid to economics and to economics activity, and one hopes to economics success. And there is also the whole structure of community prestige, something that Texans have always been looking for, sometimes for good reason.
You've written that capitalism punishes those who it seems most to reward. What did you mean by that, and is that dynamic at play with Enron today?
Oh, without a doubt. Enron was featured as a success. I must say, not in my thinking, because to my dissatisfaction, I didn't know much about it. But it was certainly one of the skyrocketing examples of what we expect in what is called the free enterprise system. Nothing there was free. And as a result, brought a level of attention to its misbehavior It's a questionable activity. You notice I avoid stronger words.
I do notice that.
That nobody ever really expected. And where there is sort of a natural protection, one doesn't, without evidence, attack an institution or an economic privileged person without some evidence.
Is there something about the boom culture of the 1990s that might have, or did, encourage what we saw in Enron? You wrote in your great book on the 1929 crash, the Great Crash, in the 50s, that the chance for a recurrence of a speculative orgy remains good. You said, during any future boom, some newly rediscovered virtuosity of the free enterprise system will be cited. Was there something in the air in the 90s that led to the great run-up of the stock market, that led to Enron? Was the new economy a new kind of elixir of illusion, or was there something real there?
I had forgotten that I said that. And you attribute to me a prescience that I really didn't have. All I had was the knowledge that at intervals of anywhere from 10 to 15 years, we have an accumulation in the economy of misbehavior, which leads to something of a crisis. We had it in the early part of this century, and we had it again in the 1930s. And then we had this extraordinary example in recent times. And I had emphasized that recurrent tendency rather than any particular event. Mm-hmm. I think it also has to be said that Enron was a footnote to history as compared to what happened before 1929 and after. That was a major step in the history of capitalism, or as we now prefer, the free enterprise system, where nothing is free.
But that was a major step in the 20s that you've been very critical of, as having set the United States up for a decade of suffering in the Great Depression.
Absolutely. The 29 crash, I don't think it's fair to say that it caused the Depression, but time and history being what it is, it ushered it in. And so the combination of the Great Crash and the Great Depression have always been linked together in analysis as they were by history.
You've written in your writings on the Great Crash how it was a long time in unfolding, that people didn't realize fully what was going on as it happened, that it took longer than people ever expected for the full impact to be felt. Do you see any parallels with today? Are we at risk of some comparable economic meltdown, or as the economists, the contemporary economists are often saying, are we now nearly out of this recession and back onto a growth track?
Nobody knows. And I wouldn't pretend to know. But I don't think there is anything as quite as bad now as there was in the great speculative explosion of the late 20s. That was a time of really incredible insanity. And I can't think that that's being repeated. But on the other hand, you can't go into the history of Enron, which I confess I haven't done before it cracked up, without seeing how incredibly foolish people can be and still seem to be getting away with it.
Professor Galbraith, when you look at the excitement that fueled the stock market run-up of the 1990s, all the talk of the information age, the new economy, you've written disdainfully about the 20s as a period when there was a lot of hucksterism behind the claims to something new. Do you see something historically new in the 90s as new technology permits a new degree of networking of the entire world?
Absolutely not. The underlying circumstance is common and recurrent. That is, people owning property, owning stock, in this case, seeing it go up in value on the market, and are immediately susceptible to some argument that it is inherent in the system, that there has been some change, that history has turned in their favor. That has always been true. And the way in which you can persuade people as to the virtue and rationale of an event which is good for them. And that has been true for a long succession of crises, going back now for almost two centuries, and was true in 1929, and has been wonderfully true in these last months and years, particularly in a firm like Enron. But there have been others.
We're listening back to a conversation with John Kenneth Galbraith. Galbraith died on Saturday at the age of 97. Galbraith never won the Nobel Prize, maybe, as some have noted, because he so often went toe-to-toe with his fellow economists and their more econometric theories. "Wealth is not without its advantages," he wrote in his famed 1958 book, The Affluent Society. "But beyond doubt, wealth is the relentless enemy of understanding." In 2002, I sat down with Galbraith at his home on the edge of Harvard University. We talked about 20th century economics and the market liberalization and free trade trends that dominated the 1990s. I asked John Kenneth Galbraith if he thought those were working.
Oh, I think it has, yes. I'm not in favor of acute protectionism that sometimes is justified, sometimes there's in some cases worthwhile, but I adhere to one of the basic precepts of my profession, my alleged profession, which is that on the whole, markets and free trade are, in the longer run, constructive forces. I don't go around making speeches against the market.
How about the level of deregulation that the economy has seen during that same decade?
Oh, there's no question that was a mistake. The people who find a regulation inconvenient never say it. That's why they're against it, or very rarely. What they say is that it's socially bad, that it's socially inappropriate, that it's socially restrictive and depression-making. And we had an outbreak of that in recent times, and it did two things. It removed regulations that might have been appropriate in the case of something like Enron, and it justified the keeping and the position of those who were doing well, those who were in it for the money.
Professor Galbraith, the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression led to a sweeping disappointment with capitalism. The setbacks of recent years to the economy, of the last couple of years, don't seem to have been nearly as severe, obviously, as you say, and don't seem to have led to much of a rethinking. What's your view of the general economic path that the United States is on as we go toward freer and freer markets and toward a more and more globalized economy?
Well, the main thing to have in mind was back in the early part of the last century, up through 1929 and after, there seemed to be a plausible alternative to the market system, to capitalism. That position has diminished, and the dominant doctrine now is we have to make the best and do the best and do what is necessary for the basic system we have. That's the big change, coupled with the inevitable counterpart that there's now a confidence in the market system which can withstand and will withstand misfortunes like the whole Enron development and the effect that that is having on other equally idiotic developments in the system.
Do you share that confidence? You coined the phrase conventional wisdom, and of course today the conventional wisdom is that the system is strong and it will, as you say, withstand these blows. Is there any reason to be concerned or to doubt that?
Oh, there's no question of that. Good times and favorable treatment by the economy are the great, great sources of false attitudes. The persuasion that comes from doing well is one of the great facts of human nature. And that is quite possibly true at the present time. But on the other hand, for what it may be worth, I don't see anything quite as vulnerable as the 1920s, for example, or occasional episodes since. But when I say the 1920s, I mean leading on to the 1930s. So I don't make my career out of the pessimism that should have been exercised in the late 1920s.
You were part of the design team for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. Of course, at the heart of that was the idea of security for American people economically. What do you think FDR would make of our economy, our world, today?
Oh, there's no question about that. He would do whatever was necessary to attract legally and properly a huge political following. He did not have a consistent, unchanged political view or economic view. He had a wonderful capacity to identify with the serviceable action or the popular action. One can't go back to that period without admiring the selection of legislation that he used to advance his own and the country's position.
So FDR was looking for what would be popular, what would make him a successful politician.
I would put it a little different. I would say he was open to that. He was open to anything that, by way of improving the economy, would improve his leadership.
And what would he make of the state of the American economy and its treatment of the whole range of American citizens, rich and poor, today?
I think he would find the state of well-being in the Republic much easier to associate with, much less dramatic in what it required than it did at the end of the 1920s. The underlying institutions now, although not without fault, there are many faults, are much better than they were in 1928, 1929, 1930.
And what do you make of the health of the U.S. economy right now? There's a lot of talk about recovery. There seems to be a recovery underway. Does it look like we could be back into healthy growth soon? Are you following it closely?
I have a iron-bound rule, and that is not to join the thousands who impressively make the wrong predictions. We could have, as a result of Enron, as a result of weaknesses elsewhere in the economy, as a result of a whole range of conditions having to do with technical development in corporations, a quite bad situation. And we could have possibly overcome that and continue to solve the worst problem of our economy, and that is the incredibly bad distribution of income and the incredibly excess income going to the top of the economy. We could have that change, see it more clearly, this need more clearly, and have a period of stability and growth. I consciously, deliberately avoid any prediction as to which it will be, partly because I don't know and more because nobody else does.
You have always been very vigilant in watching income distribution in the United States, and you've often spoke against the heavy concentration of income and wealth at the top of the scale. You've also written and spoken against tax cuts for the wealthy. Now we have both heavy income concentration at the top and recently tax cuts for the wealthy. What's wrong with this formula in your mind?
It's very inconsistent with an equitable position in the larger society. The best economy is the one which treats everybody as much alike as their personal contribution allows. We have a bad distribution of income, which could be a frail point for the system as a whole. I'm not pessimistic, but I don't think we should ever lose sight of the fact that the good economy is one that has a generally equitable reward for all of its participants.
Let's turn to September 11th, if we may. What do you make of the terrorist attacks of that day? Everyone has asked since then, why did this happen? What's your assessment?
Well, my assessment is less magnificent than some. I think this was an operation of a relatively small group in the world who saw that opening, exploited it. I don't think it was a characterization of the great masses of the people of the economic, political world. Therefore, for what it may be worth, and I'm not appealing to any satisfaction in my own commitment to the future, but for what it may be worth, I don't think this was the first step in any major similar disaster. I think it was the extraordinary effort of a relatively small criminal class.
In that case, what do you think of the Bush administration's global war on terror, which has been its response?
I think there were two things. I think on behalf of George Bush, whom I don't ordinarily support with great enthusiasm, there was the need to see this as a shocking thing, a frightening thing for the American people. And I'm very much afraid also that he saw or came to see how the world war on terrorism, consolidates a political position. And it did, and has. I'm in favor of seeing this as a miserable manifestation of modern life, but I'm not in favor of seeing it as the basis for political support or action.
You said that Bush may have felt a need to respond in terms of war to this for political reasons. Why so?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, the American people, and this is true of other countries, have an inbuilt lesson that they must come together in a cohesive way when the word war is used. That was true of World War I, World War II particularly, and was exploited even on the lesser conflicts since, unsuccessfully in the case of Vietnam. And that's the resort of any politician who is in a position of political weakness is to have that word come to his defense.
You were almost middle-aged when Pearl Harbor took place. September 11th has been widely compared with Pearl Harbor. Do you see any appropriate parallels there?
Oh, sure. That's what I was just saying, that the word war brings a sense of unity and an agreement on purpose like nothing else.
So Pearl Harbor gave FDR the platform to bring the nation to war.
I was in Washington at the time. I went to the great meeting in Knudsen's office the night of Pearl Harbor, and I was struck, as everybody was, that the contending positions in the administration in the New Deal were being, on that very evening, put aside. I remained a New Dealer, but the war, like everybody else, became the dominant problem to which one surrendered his views to some extent.
We're listening back to a conversation with John Kenneth Galbraith. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by economist Robert Solo and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty for a look at Galbraith's legacy. But first, a bit more of my conversation with Galbraith on March 11, 2002. It was the six-month anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. U.S. troops were in Afghanistan, and the nation had been put on a war footing against terrorism. I asked Galbraith what he made of the post-9/11 increases in U.S. military spending.
This is what somebody has called military Keynesianism, putting the government on the side of expenditure and employment and new business activity. And I think that having been on the edge of a serious recession, that this was one of the expanding factors as far as the economy was concerned.
Is it a substitute then for a stimulus package that Congress has been asked to provide? Is it just as good?
It's not as good, because I want a stimulus package which reflects the needs of people here in the United States and abroad. And war and preparation for war, armament, doesn't do that. But that it can have the same employment and the same expansive economic effect is entirely possible, entirely to be expected.
The case has been made that global inequities may in some way be behind the animosity that led to September 11th. How should Americans think about the importance of the distribution of wealth and income, of quality of life globally?
That's a very good question. And when I say a question is good, that's so exceptional that you should relax and smile.
Okay, I will.
I think there's no question that that is true. And I think also, going a step further, there's one point about which we should be concerned, and that is the danger, the real danger that we use international crises as a stimulant for our own economy. I want to see our economy, when it needs a stimulant, as it often does, respond to a welfare, a kindness, a humane need, and not to sending soldiers into battle, or nowadays sending airplanes to bomb innocent people.
Professor Galbraith, it has emerged that the Bush administration is reconsidering the United States policy on nuclear weapons. While the details are still a bit unclear, it seems that there is a larger readiness to signal to the world, perhaps a greater readiness to use nuclear weapons than had previously been the case. Does this seem necessary to you, or how do you judge it?
There are times when even on a radio program, one should be categorical. That is alarming because it is very unwise. We've been saved since World War II by the extraordinary good fortune that has kept nuclear weapons out of use. And this is very important to continue because it is something on which survival of all of us depends. I was director of the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey at the end of World War II here and in Japan. It left me with an enduring worry, an enduring impression of the cruelty of bombing as we did it in Germany and Japan. But it also left me with an overwhelming impression of the danger to civilization that comes from nuclear warfare, the total danger.
And yet, the bar seems to be lowered a bit by this new policy.
I would be against the policy. Use your phrase, I am strongly against anything that lowers that barrier. And the people who talk that way should realize it too.
You have watched the interplay of economies and nations for a long time now. On this 6-month observance of 9/11, we're all looking for perspective. What are the most important things we need to be thinking about in terms of our attitudes toward the national economy, the global economy, human culture in this new century, to steer away from the kinds of conflicts that we now see ourselves in?
We must see that the relationship between peace and human survival has never been closer, and that we must see conflict, not only of nuclear conflict, but of any modern warfare, as something which human survival requires. And that must have a preeminent authority in our policy and our thought.
Do you see the globalization of the world economy pushing us closer to peace? Is it a force for peace? Or might it be pursued differently that would make it more effective in bringing peace?
I don't see any dangerous movement from globalization to war. And I think on the whole, bringing countries together through trade, social intercourse, intellectual intercourse, is one of the great peacemaking activities of our time. And there are spectacular examples of how successful that can be. I was born and brought up in Canada. There was a time then in my youth when there was tension between the two countries. A great campaign in Canada in 1911 was fought on the doctrine of no truck or trade with the Yankees. And we've seen how agreeable that relationship has become over the years. Minor problems here and there, but nothing that arouses tension. And that's the kind of world I want to live in. And that's the kind of world that is destroyed by military and certainly by nuclear fears.
You've written and spoken about the unfinished business of the 20th century. What do you think are the most important unfinished tasks now?
Oh, no question. I'd be repeating myself. The lingering commitment to military disaster.
What do you mean by that?
That we haven't extruded from thought and action the possibility of war, including increasingly devastating war.
And yet, only in these 6 months, we've leapt to the word war in response to an attack.
That is something which I very much regret. I think to some extent we used war as the cover for other needs, including a measure of public unity that it brings along with much higher costs, much higher dangers. I think we must all agree, or should all agree, that war now has the possibility of ending all civilized life.
John Kenneth Galbraith, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
John Kenneth Galbraith from a 2002 interview in the library of his Cambridge, Massachusetts home. Galbraith died on Saturday. He was 97. As we heard, Galbraith often chafed at free market theory and believed in the economics of John Maynard Keynes. That put him at odds with many fellow Bigfoot economists. Some say it dimmed the light of Galbraith's ultimate influence. Joining me now for more on Galbraith's economic legacy is another giant of the field, Robert Solow. In 1987, Solow won the Nobel Prize for his analysis of economic growth. He's professor emeritus of economics at MIT, former member of the Federal Reserve Bank Board of Directors, past president of the American Economics Association, and author of many books, including Capital Theory and the Rate of Return. He's currently a fellow at the Russell Sage Foundation and joins us from New York. Robert Solow, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Also,
well,
with
it's sort of a pleasure, anyhow.
Yes, sort of a pleasure under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Solow.
Professor Solow, John Kenneth Galbraith, and now we hear his voice in our ears, and we will not hear it live again. How do you see his standing as an economist, as a thinker, in the century we've just come out of?
Well, it struck me as I was listening to the interview how little of it was actually about economics and how much was about the broader society and international society. If you were interviewing me, we would talk about essentially nothing but economics because that's what I know. And I think that Ken Galbraith's legacy is not primarily as an economist, as one of the... In fact, there was a lot of tension during his life between him and the economics profession. He felt that it paid no attention or inadequate attention to him, and so he decided at a fairly early age to make his appeal elsewhere, not to talk primarily to his professional fellows, but to the wider world. And I think that the economics profession, in fact, didn't find what he was good at, superb at, and what he did to be useful in their daily lives, so to speak. So there is always that tension. I think that a lot of what we owe to Ken Galbraith is an important side of economics, but away from the daily business of economists.
So do you see him as more a political figure than economist? I mean, he was a big influence behind the surge in federal spending in the 1960s, the Great Society, and the worldview that promoted that.
I wouldn't say political figure. I think that he was an intellectual figure. The phrase public intellectual is used of practically anybody who opens his or her mouth these days. But Ken, I think, earned that label. He spoke plainly, also sometimes elaborately, about all sorts of things. And when he did, people listened, not only political figures, but ordinary, well, mostly educated anyhow, people paid attention to him. And if I have hopes for his legacy, it would be on some of those things. I thought, for instance, that The Affluent Society was easily his best book. The ideas there about private affluence and public squalor are still true, especially true for the U.S., for much the same reasons that he described then. And I hope that book will be read for a long time, and there will be people to take up the cause that it started. Or take another example. You began the interview by talking about Enron, and I enjoyed that a lot. I think one of Ken's great characteristics, and I hope part of his legacy, was that, like a hero of his and mine, Thorstein Veblen, he was terrific at poking fun at the pompous, self-appointed natural elite of the successful, rich, and powerful, and the sort of cynicism that came out of what he said about the sort of wonderful tales that the rich and powerful spin and sell about themselves,
about what they're up to.
Yeah, and that how, and his Ken's capacity to poke holes in that.
Jack Beatty,
that's a really great contribution to public discourse, and I hope it never goes away. I don't know who's going to follow it up.
Pick up that banner. Jack, Robert Solow says Galbraith really a figure beyond economics. You heard him say in the interview there, calling economics my alleged profession. How will you remember this man, Jack?
Oh, well, I mean, he was, as Professor Solow says, the public intellectual of liberalism of the post-war era. And, you know, unlike many of his colleagues, partly because he was Canadian-born, he was saved from some of the distorting effects of the Cold War. Surely he was anti-communist, but it wasn't with him a rancid passion, as it became for many liberals who had to almost prove that they were not communist or leftist. And the result is that when you go back and read him, he's free of that of that obsession, of the McCarthyism, of the communism, and there's an objectivity about his work that even in Professor Schlesinger, whom I greatly admire, even in his work in the 50s, you don't see as much. So I think he really kept a kind of outsider's look at America that allowed him to see us whole and without this infusion of ideological passion.
Jack, Robert Solow, I want to thank both of you for being with us at the tail end of our last interview with John Kenneth Galbraith. Robert Solow, Nobel Prize winner in economics, professor emeritus at MIT, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Jack, thanks as always for being
here. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.